Well, it's the day after, and, well, not much really has changed. Next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's edition of Principles and Policies. I'm your host, Barry Sheets, the Executive Director of the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is our co-host, the Vice Chairman of the Institute, my fellow analyst, and very good friend, Chuck Mike.
Hey, Barry. It's very, very good to be back with you. It's not a great day. Weather-wise, it's lovely.
Yes.
We're sitting here continuing to scratch our heads over some of the things we see in the election results. We've discussed it off-air, and now we're going to discuss it on-air. And maybe we'll come to some conclusion about why. Well, maybe somebody can come up with an explanation and tell us why this isn't schizophrenia personified.
Well, I'd love to hear that because I'm that's exactly where my thought process is taking me. Is that's exactly what this is schizophrenia personified. And if you're not figuring out what we're talking about the May 8th primary elections that happened across Ohio. And all of the things that happen both from the federal and the state level all the way down to your local county levels. Chuck, you and I said this off air before we came on here was people have said time and time again that they don't like the way things are happening in Washington. You see congressional approval ratings and, you know, and they've dipped down as low as the single digits in some points. They don't think it's operating effectively. They don't even know if it's operating at all the way obviously not the way it should be, not the way it's constitutionally structured. And they want change. They want something different. They're dissatisfied with the status quo. Part of the reason why you saw a big wave in 2016, which moved us a lot closer to that effort. But, Chuck, that's, I think, the big problem. People believe that change is going to occur by voting one individual in office, and that is a president. And if we just get our guy there, everything's going to be okay. The world will turn correctly on its axis again.
Right.
the sun will shine brighter. The birds will sing more merrily. The air will smell sweeter. And flowers will grow under our feet where we trod. I got news for you, folks. If you are thinking that, then I've got a book you probably should read called Utopia, because that's what you're trying to live in, is a utopian fantasy that all it takes is one election and one vote, and everything's good. Now, Chuck, you and I know it isn't even about elections. It's not about voting. It's about turning the hearts of men back to Christ Jesus and his word and following his commandments.
Exactly.
You know, that's the only thing that's going to fix the mess. But in the meantime, we are given, as his vice regents here on earth, to carry out his will and that includes politics. So folks, stop kidding yourselves. Do you think that we shouldn't be talking about faith and politics together, that somehow they're mutually exclusive to each other? They're not. The Bible doesn't make that kind of separation and differentiation, even if you want to try to read Romans 13 incorrectly. We've talked about it.
Right.
You can go back in our archives and see many, many programs where we've discussed how to interpret Romans 13 from a biblically consistent viewpoint.
Yeah, it's Gnostic. It's a Gnostic view of your faith. If you believe that, you have to believe essentially that Jesus is not also the God of politics.
Yeah. Now, I will say one thing, Chuck. In some of these races, if you are a what they consider a social justice type person, that your view of the Gospels and of the scriptural admonitions are more toward righting all the wrongs and humanistically balancing out all of the assorted slights and errors that have been made throughout history, and you have to do that now in this generation, you may have been somewhat satisfied with some of the outcomes of this election. If you were biblically focused and believe that God is not going to be mocked and we need to follow him and we need to seek to strive to put the most consistently ethical, biblical, moral people in office in order that we may have peace in our kingdoms, you probably weren't necessarily as happy with the outcome as some others are. If you just don't care and it was all about what party gets to hold on to power, well, that really isn't what a primary is necessarily
right.
all about, because it's just basically that party. But it is about that, because it is that party and those party regulars and those party leaders basically kind of telling everybody else, this is who we want, in order to continue on with our hegemony or with our assault upon the mount, so that we may take over the summit and grab hold of the power ring ourselves. That's really what it gets down to. And of course, as much as we said there, Chuck, that, you know, as you hear across the land, and of course, maybe we're just too narrow, Chuck. Maybe that's it. maybe we're keeping ourselves isolated in this little fishbowl where we're only feeding ourselves feeds and information from people who think exactly like us and look like us, sound like us, talk like us, and are exactly like us.
Yes, although it's us.
In my Facebook feed, you'd know that it wasn't that case.
It's us. It's nobody else. It's us. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe it's just us. Maybe it's just us, you know, being dissatisfied. Everybody else is just happy with what happened because.
Well, you actually.
Let me just put it this way, Chuck. Of the 11 plus million inhabitants of the state of Ohio, there are approximately 7.9 million who are legally registered to vote and are of voting age in this state. Okay? And you would think that I don't care what shade you are, from ultra biblical conservative to ultra humanistic leftist, you should understand that civic engagement is a key portion of your holistic worldview. And so therefore it should be important to you to go out there and strive for what you believe to be truth. And of course that is represented by the people we pick to rule over us, as they say, although, you know, we're a democracy, Chuck. We don't have people ruling over us. We're actually a constitutional republic. We're supposed to rule over them.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
But regardless of where you're at on that philosophical and worldview spectrum, you would think with 7.9 million registered voters, and whether they're evangelical Christians, they're of other faiths, they're of no faith at all, or they just are as apathetic as all get out, you would think that when the opportunity comes to make a choice between different individuals to represent, well, not only your parties, but oftentimes as an extension, your worldview beliefs, and to take over the offices where either by legislation or by force they can exercise dominion and advance those viewpoints, that you would pay some attention and you would actually do something, whether it's make a effort to ask for an absentee ballot during the 30 to 45 days before the election that we now have, that you can like pull a ballot and vote, or you can take just a little bit of effort, whether it's before you go into work in the morning, in the midday, on your lunch hour, after, as you're getting off work before you come home, or if you are more flexible like Chuck and I are, and you know we carry our work with us everywhere we go, just whenever you get the extra 15 or 20 minutes it is to pop over to your polling place and pull a card and punch a few buttons and go back out again.
It took me half an hour to drive up to my polling place, pull the ballot, vote, and get back in the car and drive home.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it really isn't that big of an effort, and it's not asking for a major sacrifice on anybody's part. But, Chuck, it's predicted that across the state of Ohio on May the 8th, the turnout of registered voters who actually came out, whether they pulled an absentee ballot or whether they actually showed up at the polls during the 13 hours of the day that you can go vote that day, from 6:30 in the morning till 7:30 in the evening, constantly. They don't break for lunch, folks. They're there all the time. The poll workers get there at 5 o'clock in the morning. You stay there till late at night on that day. That you would have had more than a 15% turnout. Okay, Chuck. That means that we had approximately a million people between all parties and of course, the independents who pull issues-only ballots, because there was a state issue on the ballot, and there were some local issues in various jurisdictions that they could have pulled a ballot to vote on. 15% of those registered voters even gave enough of a care to go out and pull a ballot. And people are still complaining about why government doesn't work. Government doesn't work because we're too lazy and apathetic to even invest that half an hour
to make sure that we're getting people in there who will make it work the way we think it should work.
Oh, okay. That, you and I asked this question. I went, what were people thinking? Well, you actually answered it in your monologue at the start. What you said was, is that there are people out there, and I would posit based on the turnout that this is the majority. There are people out there that really don't care who wears the party mantle as long as they win in the fall.
Yeah, because it's all about the party staying in power.
It's about all about R or D. It's not about the individual. Right. Yeah.
If you don't believe that to be the case, just go back and dig through your trash cans, folks, at all of the slicks and mailers you just received over the last few weeks moving up to Tuesday's election to see that that's exactly what it was all about. It was all about power. It was all about the fact that, well, we got to vote this person into office because if we don't, oh, the other party could take the seat in November. Or if you don't vote me in, you know, we won't be carrying on the Trump legacy or whatever it might have been. Or if you don't vote for me, then you get a establishment corporatist instead of the thoroughgoing socialist in Dennis Kucinich.
Yeah, well,
look at
yeah.
those mailers. That's yeah. what it was all about. It, frankly, they could care less. It's just that each one of those individuals happened to be the standard bearer for the interests behind them, whether it be the U.S. Senate. You had, what, five people on the ballot for U.S. Senate? Probably one or two of them were only on there because, well, they felt like people needed a choice. The other ones were on there because it was either about aggrandizement and power for themselves or they were carrying the water for some interest who believes that they need to have more control and more power.
And I'll give you a third choice. They're stealth candidates to split the vote. They're stealthers running cloaked as conservatives to split the conservative vote.
Yep, that's and we're going to talk about one of those because as I'm doing my post-election analysis, it just became painfully evident what the game was in one of the districts. And I bet that the problem is, Chuck, that after the race is over with, you know, the old saying is the victors write the history books. Well, the victors also get the media. And so nobody bothers to pay attention to those who didn't win or what was the calculus behind why they were running in the first place. You won't see that in the media. You know, you're going to see so-and-so clung on to victory or charged to victory or is going to be the standard bearer. Yeah, that's all the media cares about. They care about the win. Because then that gives them the opportunity to set the battle of the century in each one of these races, you know, between Joker X from one party and Joker Y from
right.
the other party.
Yeah, Hitler versus Stalin, as we joke
yeah,
occasionally.
Hitler versus Stalin, as yeah. you so eloquently put it on Tuesday night when you're texting me.
Yeah, I'm sort of like, yeah, which one do you root for? How about neither? You just sit back and watch them beat each other to death.
Okay,
yeah.
and this is another thing, and I'm glad you said that, because, and of course, we're going to get into breaking down some of these specific races, of course, we talked about before, in a little bit, but I think we need to start here by talking about some general principles. And one of the general principles that I'm seeing right now, Chuck, is that a lot of people whose preferred candidate didn't manage to be successful during the primary are going usually one of three ways. Okay? They're either... And you and I texted about this last time. Well, I was on a roll on Tuesday night. I was blistering Chuck on my and I wasn't blistering him, but I was just blistering out my frustrations and my disgust with all things political over text on Tuesday night. So basically I said that, you know, what I'm seeing almost immediately out of these people were these folks whose horse won this first leg of the long race. Basically out there spinning as hard as they can how we need to come together and unify behind the candidate so that we can win in November and we don't give up the seat to the other party. Funny thing is,
it wasn't about unity. It wasn't about saying, well, you know, the best person should win and let's all talk about our ideas and then let the voters decide who, which one of us has the best ideas. Chuck, if that had been the lead up from December all the way through May the 8th, and yes, I mean the day of the election, because it was still going on.
Yeah.
If that had been the lead up in many of these races, I don't even think we'd need to be talking about it. We would all be unified because we'd be like, okay, you know what? Maybe I don't agree with policy X or Y from your candidate, and you didn't agree with policy Z and B squared in my candidate. But by golly, you know what? I know where they stand, and fair enough. Everybody fought a good race, and that person was the victor and won by a little bit or by a lot either way. And yeah, let's go ahead and sit down and figure out how we're going to now go after our shared opposition. But that's not what you get when you get done with these races, because in the vast majority of these races, especially the bigger ticket items, you know, the marquee matches, as we yep. call them, it was a bloodbath.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. We say mudslinging because everybody just, you know, mud's kind of, Chuck, this was like reaching down in the septic tank and grabbing handfuls.
It was,
weren't slinging mud. They were slinging sludge. Okay, folks, I'm sorry if you're a little offended by that, but by God, you really need to get that visual in your head.
Yeah.
These people, by and large, both sides were out there slinging a lot of sludge. But it's not a surprise. Because it isn't about who's got the better ideas, Chuck. It isn't about who is going to be the strongest people to make the tough decisions in order to help people and right our economy and set us on a good path and make us better as a community in this state. It's about who gets to control the levers of power and put their friends into high places and give appointments to their donors and their special interest groups. That's what it's about.
Yeah.
And so when they're challenged in that assumption that they should be the heir apparent to everything, they get a little testy, and so that's when all the nasty grams start coming out, and you get all the slick mailers and the television ads and the ominous-sounding music radio spots. And then you've got that one faction who's usually part of the winners talking about how we all need to come together and unify so we can beat our common foe. And I have to ask them, who is really the common foe? Is it the person across the political divide in the other party? Or was it the person who just spent, in some cases, millions of dollars...
Millions, yeah,
trying
millions.
...trying to coat me in sludge? Which one is it? I mean, that's really what it gets down to. So, yes, let's talk about unity. Let's talk about how we unify.
I just called you the worst kind of common... beyond the worst kind of common criminal... that's out there. I accused you of corruption in office. I accused you of essentially being a two-faced. I've accused you of doing all these horrible things, taking money from bad interest groups, but now you're supposed to get behind me and it's supposed to be all smiles and pats on the back, and you support me in my effort to win the office.
It was kind of funny because, you know, during that primary, especially the governor's race, there was a time when Mary Taylor, who was on the head of the one ticket, basically was asked, if you don't win the primary, will you support your opponent in the general election? And she said, no.
Good.
And you know what? People were angry at her for that. How dare you? How dare you not be a unifying force? Blah, blah, blah. Well, maybe she didn't dare because they were just at that same time rolling out television ads, basically attacking her, her family, her family's business, basically making it personal. Gee. Yeah, and I'm supposed to smile broadly while these people, you know, with their millions of dollars of outside money coming in, basically rake me over the coals, and then they win by, well, and in this case, I think it's lack of turnout. And I'm supposed to then turn around and smile and kiss up to them and say how wonderful they are. Okay, I get it. I get why I said no. Now, does that mean that when we get down toward October, November, if they go back around to that not successful candidate and say, are you supporting the home team in the election? I fully expect them to say yes. I fully expect them to say, we got to get behind so-and-so and win it for the good guys. And of course, I'm not just sitting here just talking about Republicans either, Chuck, because the Democrats are going to do the same thing. They had a nasty, nasty fight up in Cleveland over a state Senate seat. And, well, to my chagrin, sadly, and of course, it seemed to be how the entire night turned out, the wrong person won.
Yeah, we seem to have a lot of that.
the nastiest, most vile, anti-God person won. But I'll guarantee you that the big reach out among them in the Cleveland and the Democrat Party in Cleveland is going to be, we need to come together and get behind her. We need to come together and get behind the candidate so that so we can keep the seat. Now, of course, it's a heavily Democrat area, so there's really no. I mean, if the other individual does not keep the does not decide to keep the peace and does not decide to get behind the candidate because they really feel that that candidate's like, you know, just abhorrent for the party or for the seat or for the people of the district, nobody's going to care because, well, it's a Democrat seat anyway. A Republican can't win the seat. So if you win the primary, you've pretty much won the general, which, you know, is a sad thing. Now, the one thing we're not going to hear about until a little bit later is how many people filed to run in some of these seats as independents going into the fall, because you got to do that the day before the primary election.
It's an absurd.
You have to file. You have to file petitions if you're going to run independently. And that, of course, we don't have that data yet.
That's called the sore loser. Yeah.
In a couple of weeks, we'll.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a couple of weeks, we'll see if there's actually any more challenges that are going on. But
that's the sore loser law, and it's absurd.
It is absurd, but that's the way it is. Now, we had the first group, which is the let's all come together now that my guys won, and so you guys need to just swallow hard and back our guy because, well, it's all about our guy getting in. Then there's the second group, who are the, well, my guy didn't win, so a pox upon you and your house, and I will never darken your doorstep again, go away, I never knew you, kind of response from those folks who are upset that their candidate didn't pull off. They didn't make it happen. And for whatever reasons, you know, whether valid or invalid, they've now chosen that they're going to take their ball and go home. I've seen a lot of that across social media too. A lot of people saying, I wouldn't vote for X, Y, and Z if you paid me, and I'm going to stay. Hey, that's kind of in one sense where I am right now.
I was going to say,
quite honest with you. You know, as I was blasting you with texts on Tuesday night, one of those texts were, I think I'll either be voting down ticket or I may not even vote, pull a ballot in November.
Well,
because frankly, I'm not one of these people. Now, again, and that'll get us to our third class of folks. I'm not one of these people who buys into the scare campaign of, well, if we don't all come around Joe Blow, then Joe Schmo gets the seat, and that's going to be even worse if the other party wins. Frankly, I'm done with that. I've never believed that to be. The lesser of two evils argument is atrocious, and it's abhorrent to me to even entertain the idea of, I mean, and again, now if it's a situation where in the two instances, like if you had challengers in a primary and I liked the one, it isn't that I hated the other, you know, in some instances it was. But in some instances it wasn't like I hated the other parties in that race. So if they won, I might be like, yeah, I'd be willing to vote for them now in the general because they weren't horrible. They weren't being stupid, and they didn't belittle themselves by being small-minded and nasty and blah, blah, and do all the stupid things that their advisors told them to do. But in some races, that's where I am. That's like pox on your house, and I frankly don't care. And the people can hand-wring all they want to between now and November, decrying how horrible it would be if we lost the majority or lost this house or lost this seat or lost this. I'm like, what does it matter? I either get, or like you said, it's a fight between Stalin and Hitler in some cases.
Yeah.
And so which one do you get behind? You know, maybe you get behind Switzerland.
You become Switzerland Stalin. And just say, yeah.
You become Switzerland.
But then
that leads me to there's that third group of folks, Chuck. And that third group of folks are those folks who were strongly partisan to one side that didn't win in that early election, but because their fear of the other guy is so strong that they are easily seduced into becoming the most perfect pawns on the face of the planet. And those are the guys who will buy into the scare tactics of, well, if we don't all get behind Joe Blow, then Joe Schmo wins it and their party takes over. And then against their own consciences, belief systems, and sometimes lots of public statements, they come out there and endorse and support and vote for the guy that just a few months ago they thought was the devil incarnate.
Well, can I remind you of what some of the same people who are saying talking unity now were saying in 2016? I seem to recall a governor,
Trump.
A governor who is currently in office, who said, "I will pledge to support the Republican nominee for president, no matter who he is." Did that happen?
I don't remember that.
Oh, he did say that during the primary season. If you recall, he was demanding that Trump take that pledge, and somebody said, "How about
That's
you?"
True.
And he said, "I take it."
That's true. Yeah, you're right.
And guess what? I think he voted for Hillary. Now, would he admit that? He would say that, you know, my vote is my business. If he says my vote is my business, I will say that's a yes.
No. Remember, he wrote in John McCain.
That's right. Now you've reminded me of something.
He cast a write-in vote for John McCain.
Yeah. Which means nothing because he wasn't a recognized write-in candidate.
Right. It was a symbolic protest that
you're right.
No way, shape, or form was he ever going to vote for Donald Trump.
Yep. So this thing, remember, this is what, in biology, if you know anything about biology, this is what's called a semipermeable membrane. A semipermeable membrane lets things cross one direction but not back over the other direction. In other words, these pledges and these unity calls work one direction, but they don't work the other direction. Rhinos get to make them and say, "Well, you need to support me now because I'm the nominee." But if they get beaten, "Oh, well, I'm afraid I will have to withdraw my support for the candidate at this time, and I'm just not sure who I'll vote for. I may not pull a ballot at all, or I may have to support the opponent or an independent."
Yeah.
That's how this works.
Yeah, that's how it works.
And don't kid yourself, that has gone on all over the place, and that includes people who were behind people who I got all the campaign literature here for all the congressional candidates. I'm registered as a Republican, so I got all the stuff from the Republican side. You know what? We've been hearing all along, candidates have to run away from Trump. They have to run away from Trump or they're going to lose, blah, 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 blah. Were all of them running towards? They were all running as fast as they could towards Trump. Where are they going to be running in the fall? Well, it depends on what the numbers look like. That brings up a good point, and that is, I think, you know, remember we heard about the blue wave that was going to hit this year? And how awful it was going to be for Republicans. Yeah. The blue wave is cresting way, way, way before November.
Yeah.
This is like
because if you look at the numbers of turnout, Republicans came out in Ohio much bigger numbers than Democrats.
Let me tell you something. I'm looking at results. I'm looking at my county results. Licking County. I'm looking at the total number of votes cast for governor, and they had 6 pairs of candidates. How many votes were cast in Licking County? Just under 8,000. Okay. For governor and lieutenant governor under the Republicans, we had 2 pairs. How many votes were cast? Just under 17,000. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
8 versus 17. That's a 2-to-1 ratio. What does that say? That says, A, people on the Democratic side are either very disaffected or there just aren't that many of them. They didn't like the candidates. Rich Cordray, essentially the front runner by significant margin in Licking County, he got 71% of the vote. And he got 5,600 votes total. DeWine in Houston got almost double that, 95-45. Well, what's that tell you? Even though almost nobody showed up, the Republicans are a lot more enthused than the Democrats are. Okay?
Yep.
The same can be said on this this race for representative. You know, to fill Pat Tiberi's seat in Licking County. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 Democrats. 7,571 votes cast. Again, just under 8,000. Or really, well, no, 500 short. So just under 7,600. And in the Republican side, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 candidates pulled almost 17,000 votes. Now, what can you say about the closeness of those races? Well, here's the deal. On that representative thing, the Democrats were all fairly close. A guy named Danny O'Connor, who I have no idea who he is, got the most votes.
He's the Franklin County auditor, I believe.
Okay. He got the most votes in this in Licking County. And he got 28%, which is a pretty fair showing among that many candidates. Other people,
yeah,
you know, essentially it's these people are more or less unknowns here. Okay, what did we have here? Well, we had two main candidates on the Republican side. We had Troy Balderson, who won, and Melanie Lenigan, who did okay.
Yeah, Lenahan.
Troy Balderson pulled almost 39% of the vote. But he didn't do that well overall the whole district. People who knew who he was wouldn't vote for him. That's what's interesting.
I believe he won with 29.7% of the vote.
Less than 700 votes separated him from Lenahan.
Lenahan had 29.2.
Yeah. Less than 700 votes separated those two.
Right.
Over the whole district. That's pretty close.
It was a very, very close election. Less than 700 votes. Now, that was both for the special election and for the general
election. And the general,
So, Balderson is the candidate now for both. But, you know, this was a situation where, and I go back to the one thing I talked about, that many of the establishment folks were screaming that, you know, if you didn't vote for Balderson, then the seat would be lost to the Democrats because Lenahan, you know, wasn't popular with people. Well, she turned out to be only 600 and some votes less popular than Troy Balderson.
Yeah, exactly.
But I'm going to make a prediction right now. I'm going to predict that Troy Balderson loses the special election
and
probably loses the general.
You think so?
Because I do believe that's a seed that the Democrats will probably put money into.
Oh, of course they will. This would be a pearl of great price. This is John Kasich's old seat.
This is John Kasich's old seat. It's their way of sending messages and to pick their momentum back up. And this district's really shaping up like that Pennsylvania district was shaping up, because O'Connor, the Democrat nominee, has got an incredibly strong ballot name, and you know he's young. And Balderson just went through a bruising primary where he's not necessarily the best liked person in the district right now.
Definitely not.
Even to the fact where you had two different of the other, because there used to be 11 candidates in that race. Two of them dropped out, and they endorsed other people other than Balderson.
Yes. Yeah.
You know. That really kind of tells you something, that it wasn't so much that Balderson was popular, it was that there was enough diffusion among the candidates to pull enough votes away from Lenahan in order to allow him to be able to squeak by and win it. Because you know, if you looked the quote unquote establishment candidates, and there were three major establishment candidates who were running in this race. One was the county prosecutor in Delaware County who'd won their county's endorsement. The other was another sitting state senator from Franklin County who won that party's endorsement and was on their slate card. But yet, those two combined didn't get the same number of votes that Lenahan got. So that means that they didn't siphon off enough votes from Balderson to keep him from winning. But then there was a guy by the name of Tim Kaine who came out of nowhere. Jumped in, came in with the most money of anybody.
I was going to say, he spent big money.
A lot of it was,
debt, but all of a sudden he comes in and he's got the biggest war chest of anybody, and he goes out there and spends a couple things, and of course he gets a puff piece in the New York Times the day before the election.
What should that tell you? What should that tell you?
That should tell you that he was the splitter.
Yep.
He was the guy who was recruited to go in to split the conservative vote. And by golly, it worked.
And that's exactly what he did.
He pulled like 16% of the vote, which, if he hadn't been in the race, I'm guessing the outcome would have been much different.
700 votes difference. If you split those votes evenly between Lenihan and Balderson, Lenihan comes out on top.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, pretty much. But that's kind of where it was with that. So, you know, I'm after looking at that race, and okay, for complete disclosure, I was part of Melanie's team, okay? I was an informal advisor. I was trying to help her, you know, get out and meet voters and raise money and do all kinds of stuff. And she was doing fantastic because, you know, she's somebody I believe in. Now, I'm not saying that Balderson's going to lose the special and probably the general election in the fall because I don't like Troy Balderson. I really could care less. You know, Balderson's been in the House and the Senate for years, and he's never been a champion. He's never been somebody you want to go to carry your legislation. He's never been somebody you want to count on if you're like counting down to the split vote to figure out where he's going to land, because you know he would just land with whatever leadership told him to do. He's a good soldier for
the establishment. Yeah.
And he will try to be a good soldier for the establishment in Congress. There won't be any changes. So the folks who are wanting change from the way things were, and again, I saw somebody said something about that the former Congressman Pat Tiberi was, you know, had 62% likability in the district. If that's the case, then Troy Balderson should have won with 50% plus of the vote, because Tiberi was completely bought into with his own money, personally endorsing Balderson, and it really didn't. And he won by less than 700 votes. Yeah. And so that's the reason why I'm saying that Balderson's probably going to lose, is because the Democrats are going to look at this as a plum. It isn't so much that he's polarizing, et cetera, although, you know, some of their ads that they ran were kind of nasty. But, you know, it's just that he's just a soldier. And he's a soldier that if a good sniper on the other side can get a beat on, they're going to take him out. So I think that, honestly, the hand-wringing that the establishment folks did and moaning about if you get Lenihan if she becomes the winner, then we're going to lose the seat to the Democrats, is probably going to flip on them, and they're probably going to lose with their own guy. But that's just where that is. You know, there's a lot of other races, Chuck. I know we're going to go probably a lot short on time today, but let's go just kick down the list here. U.S. Senate primary, obviously in the Democrat side, Sherrod Brown is running for re-election, so he had no opposition.
Yeah, he was no opposition.
And everybody hates Sherrod. Okay, if you talk to any Republican, Sherrod Brown is public enemy number one. I don't understand why, but he's public enemy number one. Honestly, for me, I think public enemy number one, if you're talking about the U.S. Senate, is Rob Portman. But hey, that's me, because I think the cancer in your own body is going to hurt you a lot more than the cancer that's in somebody else's body.
There was an article that you and I traded back and forth a couple weeks ago that talked about, I'm trying to remember who did the survey, but the survey came out that the most quote unquote bipartisan member of the Senate was Rob Portman. Now, let me translate bipartisan. Bipartisan means the most likely to cross the aisle and vote with the other side, when there's a major issue at stake. Rob Portman is the most likely to sell you out to the Democrats. That's the bottom line on what that means.
Yeah, that's basically what that goes to.
Yeah, so
but Rob's not up for election, so Sherrod is. So
yep.
So you had a slew of Republicans, at least five, running against Sherrod Brown, basically. But they were running against each other. And the ultimate winner on Tuesday was Jim Renacci, who is a sitting U.S. congressman from the Medina area, who basically started this cycle wanting to be governor because he was sick of the swamp and he didn't want to be in D.C. anymore and he couldn't get anything done. So he was running in a four-way primary for governor, which then became a three-way primary when John Houston decided to fold his personal tent and pitch it with Mike DeWine to become his running mate. And then Josh Mandel, who was the who's the state treasurer who was running for the seat, had to step out because of some serious health issues that had started occurring with his wife. And I found out what that was, Chuck. I know we never, I don't think we ever talked specifically about it, but his wife has been diagnosed with a severe form of Meniere's disease.
That one,
which, if you know anything about Meniere's, it is one that it can incapacitate you. It's a inner ear balance gyroscope malfunction that basically causes your world to go out from under you in 15 different directions without warning. I had a good friend who worked with me when I worked in the state house who was undiagnosed and contracted Meniere's disease. And I don't know, and I don't even think they really know how it begins. But we're sitting here talking one day, and he's looking at me, and all of a sudden he turns green as a ghost. He grabs for his trash can, and he starts throwing up. And I'm thinking, this guy doesn't smoke, he doesn't drink, he doesn't do anything, he doesn't party. So it wasn't like the bad effects of, you know, the night before, so I'm thinking food poisoning. He goes to get up, and he falls on the floor. He cannot walk. So we get him over onto the boss's couch and lay him there for a while and call, you know, get some medical attention to him. They take him to the hospital. They start running tests. They find out he's got Meniere's disease, which is an inner ear issue. And I don't know if it's bacterial or
nobody
like
knows.
Physical damage. Or nobody knows.
Nobody knows.
Well, that's what Josh Mandel's wife contracted. And it's a severe form from what I understand. So, you know, they got three little kids. If you've got Meniere's, it's going to be very, very difficult for you to even remotely try to manage children while your husband's out on the campaign trail crisscrossing the state trying to win a Senate seat.
Yeah.
So he stepped out. So kudos to Mandel for taking care of family first. So Jim Renacci all of a sudden decided he's going to run get out of the governor's race because he's realized that he probably can't win it, and he jumps over to the U.S. Senate race. Well, there was already a couple of challengers to Mandel. One was a guy by the name of Mike Gibbons, who's a multimillionaire businessman out of Cleveland. And the other person was Melissa Akeson, who is a grassroots activist from Marysville area. Of course, there were a couple others who entered the race as well, but and one of them's friends of yours and mine, but they were complete also-rans who were really just on the ballot because they felt like they needed to be on the ballot.
One of our friend on the ballot runs almost every time, and almost every time he pulls the same number of votes.
Yeah, about 2%.
Yeah.
And God bless him. I love Don to death.
Yep.
Don Eckert. But, you know, and this, it just, it wasn't going to happen.
Well,
so Jim Renacci ends up winning with about 40-some percent of the vote.
Right.
So he will be the standard bearer for the Republicans going into November against Sherrod Brown. And this is going to be one of those cases, Chuck, where you're going to see a lot of number three happening. People who didn't support Jim Renacci, didn't think he was the right guy, who supported Akeson or Gibbons or any of the others, who are going to be like, well, we got to beat Sherrod Brown. So all of a sudden, Jim Renacci becomes their new best friend.
Yep. Well, let me tell you, just
that's
Licking,
the kind of stuff I have problems with.
Licking County results, Mike Gibbons won.
And he won in a few counties, but he didn't win enough in order to make it work.
He won by 700 votes here. And by the way, Don got 4% of the vote here.
Oh, okay. Well, that's good. But statewide, it kind of like narrows down a little bit more.
It doesn't get you much. Yeah.
Yeah, that gets you a little ways, but probably not as far as you want to go. So
some of these people, I have no idea who they are. There was a write-in who got 0 votes in Licking County.
Yeah, well, that can happen, and sadly, if you think about it, there was a write-in who got 0 votes. That means that person didn't even write their own name in.
Well, in Licking County, he may not be from Licking County.
Oh, he may not have voted in the. Let's write it because it's for Congress, for U.S. Senate.
So, now
I get that.
There was a Green candidate.
Sorry, I wasn't tracking with you as well as I should have been.
Yeah, there was a Green candidate who got 0 votes in Licking County. Filena Irene Farley.
Well, if there was a Greenie, there'll be more people on the ballot in November. There you go. So that's good. But anyhow, so that's where it's shaping up. So it's Sherrod Brown mainly versus Jim Renacci with maybe a Green or an independent candidate running as well. But the vast majority of people are going to come over
yeah, from the Republican side are going to come over and are going to embrace Jim Renacci
yeah.
to be the guy who takes out the devil. Of course, then you go down, you got the congressional seats. We just talked about the 12th. There were a couple of others, but honestly, they went the same way. Money and establishment backing and endorsements, you know, won the day for them. Then you get down to the state house, and, well, Chuck, that's where things kind of took a different kind of turn.
Yes, very different.
And we've talked about this on the program. There's a big fight for who's going to be the next Speaker of the House between Ryan Smith here in my backyard down in Bidwell, which is just 6 miles away from where I live, and Larry Householder from Perry County, who was the former Speaker back in the early 2000s, who came back in, got back in the legislature, and he's wanting to be Speaker. Well, there were, I believe it was 17 contested races, 13 or 14 open seats, and two or three there were incumbents in that were getting challenges from one or the other of these two guys and their group. So there was about 17 or 18 races where they were going head-to-head with each other. Okay? Now, we've had since the scandal with the current Speaker resigning because of improprieties in an FBI investigation, we now have an announcement that next week, on the 15th of May, there is going to be a vote for the new Speaker of the House. Now, oddsmakers were already looking at the fact that this election was probably going to go a long way in determining who that Speaker is going to be. And I agree with that. But it didn't turn out the way I think most of them thought it would. Because of those 17 races, Chuck, Team Householder won at least 14 of them.
Yeah, it does not bode well for...
It does not bode well for Ryan Smith.
No.
But Smith's argument and his support would be right now that the current leadership team, who will be calling for the election, may try to say, we're going to vote him in now because he's got enough votes in the caucus to become the next Speaker for the rest of the term, which then gives him the ability to control the caucus monies, and he could end up cutting off caucus monies to a number of these newly won primary seats who didn't go his way, and lose them to the Democrats. Because remember, they've got a 66-33 advantage. They could lose 15 seats and still be in the majority.
Yeah, that
now,
would,
losing 15 yeah. seats would not bode well for Ryan Smith being Speaker in the next cycle, because his own caucus would have a problem with that. But there might be just enough of a handful of seats where they just decide they're going to reprioritize monies in different areas in order to lose these seats to Democrats. I can say there's one that's just a glaring example, and it's up in Cleveland. It's the 6th House District. Michael Canty, who was a mayor up there and a big union guy, was the Smith candidate. Jim Trakas, a former member of the House, was the
yep.
Householder candidate. Trakas won with 57% of the vote after hundreds of thousands of dollars had been spent by his opposition and by Team Smith to knock him out of the block.
That's pretty.
I'm guessing that if Ryan Smith becomes the Speaker because they take the current caucus members and just say that and Ryan says he's got enough to be Speaker, he controls the caucus money. Then I'm guessing Jim Trakas is out in the cold with getting any money from the caucus to run his November election in Cleveland, which, even though it's somewhat of a Republican seat, a good Democrat with some money behind them could take the seat.
Yeah, it wouldn't look.
Would they be willing to give some of those up? Yeah, they'd be willing to give
again,
some of those up.
Again, this is one of those
that
unity goes one way and not the other.
Right, because the ones that they're holding on to who are going to, like the incumbents who are going to stay in for the next cycle, are still going to be votes for Smith, and many of them who came in, and I'll guarantee you, there'll be a small handful of them who might win in November as a Householder back candidate, but if Ryan Smith is the sitting Speaker asking to be reelected, there will be a number of them who will defect and go over and vote for Smith because they don't want to be on the outside looking in when it comes to committee assignments and, you know, all the little whistles and bells that can be given to them. Now, I feel sorry for them because it's fairly clear that
even if he doesn't make it this cycle, Larry Householder is going to be Speaker. Because if he doesn't win it this next cycle, Ryan Smith's out in 2 years, and Larry Householder's got six left to go. So he'll probably run for and most likely win Speaker at least 2 years out for at least a four-year term. And showing how he did in this primary, it won't take much for him to next cycle to raise up a number of other candidates to ensure that. With an outgoing Speaker who won't be able to really protect those people who voted for him while he was then there. So it may be very interesting on Tuesday. I'm waiting to see if they just say, okay, listen, Larry, you did it. You cleaned that. You ran the table. You can be Speaker the rest of the term, and then you've got it going into the next session because your folks will be coming in after November, after the November election. And honestly, other than a couple of those races, Chuck, like I said, that's up in the Cleveland area. The vast majority of the seats that the Householder team won were all in secure Republican districts.
Yeah. So
it's going to be very difficult for him to lose too many of those going into the fall unless Ryan Smith becomes the new Speaker.
Isn't it a sad day when you sit here and talk about the Speaker of the House is willing to lose seats to hold on to a position of power?
But just remember, Chuck, power is not universally distributed. It is concentrated.
Yes, that's
and
true.
That's the seductive lie about power. Everybody wants their guys to have power, but only one guy's going to have power. And that's really what it gets down to, because that's what the Speaker election's all about. Who's going to wield the gavel, hand out the committee assignments, hand out the chairmanships, hand out the special committees and the perks and the bonuses? Who's going to control the caucus money for elections? That's what it's all about. And it gets down to one person. Now, their problem was the last person they picked, it got seduced too heavily by that power and got sloppy and got careless and started trying to accrue more personal power than was legitimate for the office. So he starts making deals and selling votes, etc. That's kind of where they're going to with this. That maybe he was blocking certain bills and moving certain bills based upon how much money certain special interests were writing to the caucus and to him. But, I mean, even with that, and one of the key races was to replace the Speaker, the winner of that primary will be seated next week. That was one of the Householder's folks. So he gained a vote. Because the Speaker's handpicked candidate and the Smith-backed candidate lost by like 10 points. So that's where we're at. So you've got all of this intrigue going on. Next week's going to be very interesting to see. And it could end up with a situation where the current leadership team realizes what kind of a jam they might be in. They really don't want Householder because, a number of the votes that are there right now are not wanting to vote for him. You might see someone else be an interim Speaker for the rest of this term because that's what it will take. As mentioned earlier in the program, the earlier programs, Dorothy Palanda is trying to do that.
Ugh.
Or in the House.
Oh my gosh.
Andy Thompson has put his name forward from the Marietta area to be the interim. Now, Thompson, I think, is on his way out, so actually he would make probably one of the better interims because...
Yep.
There'd be no reason for him to want to stand up and, become the next Speaker because he can't, because he's going to be out. Palanda, though, who was going to run for Secretary of State until deals were cut to clear the way for Frank LaRose, is now wanting to become the consensus candidate to avoid all the bloodshed so that she could be Speaker. But the problem is that I believe Palanda has another term that's coming up. So what she's really trying to do is she's trying to muscle her way in to become the next year's Speaker. It gets stranger and stranger. But again, next week we'll have some very interesting things to report on how that leadership election turned out, how things are going forward from there, what some of the candidates who may have not have won are going to declare, because you're probably going to have candidates are going to come out and say whether they're going to like back their opponent or if they're just done with it or if they're planning on staying in the game and figuring out something else to do.
Well, in our last few minutes, I want to interject because I want to talk about State Issue 1. We did come out four square against state issue one. And obviously, at least in Licking County, 70% of the voters said we were full of jelly. We didn't know what we were talking about.
Pretty much across the state.
Yeah, well, I was going to say.
72%.
Yeah. I mean, it was a bloodbath. It wasn't even close. And what it told me was that there is definitely schizophrenia amongst the voters. And what I mean by that. Well, what I mean was they voted here for change. They didn't, the electorate in general, I don't really think they understood the issue. Or they'd have voted no. Because this really doesn't take it out of the hands of partisans and place it into nonpartisans. What it did was it took it out of the hands of elected officials and put it in the hands of unelected officials. And in fact, in the end, it's probably most likely going to end up going into the hands of the courts, which is the worst thing you can imagine. You think the districts look gerrymandered now? You wait till the courts are designing the districts. It's going to be
And if you don't think the courts are going to be designing these districts, I got another one for you.
Folks, you're going to be begging and pleading that somebody comes up with a repeal motion here in probably about 5 years, if it takes that long.
Yep.
You're going to be begging and pleading for a change to this system that you just voted in. It's going to be a mess. Now, of course, one of the candidates for Lieutenant Governor, John Houston, who's the Secretary of State, was all for this thing. And you're going to find out why he was dead wrong on this. It's going to be a bigger mess than it ever was under the old system. But again, this is that schizophrenia. And by that, I mean voters wanted change. But they didn't really want change because what did they do? They went with the party endorsed and former seat holder endorsed candidates in almost every case. In our district, Pat Tiberi endorsed Troy Balderson. Now, as Barry pointed out, it didn't get him as much as he thought he was going to get out of it. he should have walked away with it in a cakewalk, and he won it by 700 votes. That's not a cakewalk. And had some of the one of the problems in this district in number 12 here with Lenahan and Balderson being the tops, there were seven other candidates in that race. It was too wide a field with this Tim Kaine guy just jumping in out of nowhere with a whole bunch of money. And as we pointed out, he was the splitter, and he did his job. I would like to know more about him. I know next to nothing about him because the stuff that came out is the same stuff that came out from all the guys that we got. And that was, he was a Trump guy. Well, I don't believe that. Sorry, I don't believe that. I certainly don't believe that Troy Balderson's a Trump guy. I think Troy Balderson is a Balderson guy. It's kind of amazing. Folks, we'd love to hear from you. If you voted for it, why you voted for it. And you can find out, you can get a hold of us at our website, www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And I don't know, Barry, what are your thoughts? You got about 30 seconds.
Well, I think it was sad that they voted, in favor of this thing on a primary ballot. Should have been on a general ballot, so everybody
yes,
would have
exactly.
to take a look at it. But secondly, thing is that I think for some of these candidates who didn't win in these congressional races in Ohio, just hold tight for about a year or so. Once this thing kicks in and they start redrawing these districts and fighting over them, you might find that there might be districts that have to be drawn because of the courts that you can actually win in.
Yes.
So, I mean, I want to encourage some of those good candidates who didn't manage to come across the finish line that there's still hope out there.
There's always hope, Barry, because God is in control.
And I personally am looking to start talking to and possibly recruiting a couple of good candidates to look at maybe 4 years from now.
Yep.
About creating a team to give voters an alternative to whoever's in the establishment, whether it's a DeWine Houston or if it's a Cordray yep. Sutton. I think we need to have better candidates for our gubernatorial and lieutenant governor.
Pick. Way better. Well, that being said, you know what we think. We want to know what you think. Again, principledpolicy.com. And join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.